We didn't let anyone give toasts. Because I feel like half the toasts you're going to hear at any wedding are going to be terrible, right? Often from men. Because again, I don't think that's something a lot of straight guys, we give ourselves this emotional access to be tender with our friends. So it just comes out real aggressive. Every groomsman speech I've ever witnessed may as well have been delivered by the groom's worst enemy on planet Earth.
That's comedian Josh Gondelman. He's the head writer for the popular late-night talk show, Desus and Meryl. Josh has a reputation for being the nicest man in comedy, so it's only fitting that his debut comedy special is called People Pleaser. And although it's been said that you can't please all of the people all of the time, Josh proves that he can please all of the people all of the time. He delivers one great joke after another about various subjects, including the experience of making a cameo appearance in a friend's dream, and a poignant true story about how he discovered that his wife Maris was the person he wanted to spend the rest of his life with. And while many comedy specials record two or more sets, Josh only needed one set to nail it. Josh joined us from his home in Borum Hill. We wondered if there was ever a time when pleasing people backfired on him.
I was just like such a goober when I was a young person. Like I really wanted to like be there for people and do things that are nice. And I think like I was so over the top until I maybe still, but definitely into my 20s where like in high school, I would like carry around a can of chicken soup, like a Progresso chicken soup. And then if somebody seemed like they weren't doing well, I'd be like, here, you got to have this can of chicken soup. That's what you need when you're not feeling well. And it's like, in retrospect, that's like a completely unreasonable thing to do. That's like not, I'm sure people were like, what the hell is this guy doing? Because like there's no place to make, there's no place to heat up chicken soup, no can openers. We went to like a pretty, you know, like their hot lunch, but like bag lunch public school where it wasn't like there was a luxurious student lounge where you could just get soup ready for eating. If you're like, oh, I have a cold and someone gave me this can of soup. So I was really just giving them like a 1 pound weight to do resistance training with as they walked through their day. And it's just like, I feel like that impulse has never fully left me, but I've like kind of worn away the parts of that, like, oh, I should really like be accommodating to people that are like completely ridiculous. I like to think, at least.
Yeah, you have a lot of empathy because you also do on Twitter, you all offer to give pep talks to people.
Yes, I do. That's been going for a long time now. And I've been a little spottier with it because it's just there. This is going to sound like a bizarre complaint, but like I have so many followers now compared to when I started doing this like 9 years ago that when I'll say, you know, I'll wait till late at night and I'll go, hey, if anybody needs a pep talk, I'm here for 5 minutes. Just let me know. And I get so many requests and I feel guilty not responding to all of them because I feel like people wouldn't reach out unless they were feeling in need. So it ends up, you know, I'll shoot the tweet out at like 11 p.m. and then I'll be up till 12:30 responding to 100 people that are like, I've got a job interview tomorrow and I'm really nervous, or like my dad is sick and I'm having a hard time splitting time between my work and caring for my family. And it's like, wow, this is real stuff. Like people are being really real. And so I really try to like respond in kind of the way people reply to me, because I don't want to be glib or I don't want to like leave people hanging when they're like, oh, I'm being vulnerable. And I'm like, sorry, I'm sleepy. So
yeah, that's great that you do that. That's wonderful that you do that. Yeah. You've been doing stand-up a long time. What was the biggest challenge you faced when you were putting together People Pleaser, your first 1 hour comedy special?
Oh, that's such a good question. So the biggest challenge was I hadn't been performing live in over a year, really. And so it was going from only doing Zoom shows and the very occasional outdoor show to like working up my sea legs to being on stage at all, to figuring out like what it looks like to do an hour with some material that I've never performed in person, some material that I had started writing a few years ago after my last album came out, right? And then figuring out what kind of bits that I had been doing for a long time, or had kind of put on the shelf, that I was like, oh, I have this opportunity to show off some material I really love to people that maybe aren't, you know, as familiar with my stand-up.
It just feels so good to be able to do that safely. Even the bad parts, even the stuff I didn't used to like, I now kind of have an affection for. I was out at a bar the other night, and I saw a guy kind of drinking, like he was trying to get drunk enough to leave the YouTube comments in his heart. And I thought to myself, I don't know about that guy. And then I was like, wait a minute, I don't know about that guy. I haven't seen a guy that I haven't known about in like a year and a half. Just been in my apartment, walking by my mirror, like, yeah, I know that guy.
So it was like putting that all together and making it feel cohesive after a 15-month layoff from getting on stage. And it was like a real interesting challenge, but it's like, I really like this, with the title of my special, this shouldn't be a surprise. I really like homework, like assignments where I'm like, ooh, this, I can do this, and then I will have this thing ready to show off. So I really kind of relished the opportunity to like get it together, figure out what I was going to wear, even like get everything ready for this recording, where I was like, okay, I've got a 4 weeks to ramp up, and then I have this one night where I have to execute this performance, and then I've done it.
Yeah, and you did it very well. Thank you for doing it so well. How do you balance writing comedy for your act with writing comedy for Desus and Meryl?
So I've been in writer's rooms full time for like the last almost 8 years, I guess, at this point. Mm-hmm. And I really had to, when I started working full time in comedy, before I was even a staff writer at Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, I was very frustrated with the pace that I was writing stand up at. And I was kind of beating myself up about it, but I had to like kind of let myself off the hook a tiny bit and go, look, this is the thing. Like I'm doing it. Like when I go to the office during the day, I'm working in comedy. This is the dream. I'm living the dream. So I can't like get mad at myself for living too much dream. So All that is to say, I do a pretty fair amount of stand-up around New York City still, and I write when I can. But my writing process is a little slower than if I were full-time doing stand-up. And I try to like be mindful of that and do sets because I enjoy doing it and because it keeps me sharp as a performer and it keeps me engaged with the material that I'm performing. So I don't feel like, oh, I haven't even said this in 6 weeks.
Here we are, we're in New York City in Tribeca, a neighborhood where I can't afford the coffee. Even the name of this neighborhood sounds rich, Tribeca. It sounds like a couple of rich kids attempting to find someone to buy cocaine from.
Just like, Tyler's out of town, Tribeca. Her parents work in pharmaceuticals.
But also like going to an office every day, I'm not traveling as much, as I would if I were on the road. I'm like, my life is like, I have a pretty like wonderful and steady rhythm. So it also, I'm like having fewer, especially in this like pandemic, lingering pandemic world, fewer like weird experiences to write about. So I'm like really trying to dig in and mine like my thoughts and daily life for material because I'm not like out having adventures, on a regular basis. So it's, and I do sometimes, I see my friends like who are full-time comics and I see the way that they like generate material and work so hard at like turning over their hour of material every 12, 18 months. And I'm so impressed. And I'm like, oh, why aren't I doing that sometimes? I'm like, oh, because I do a different thing all day. And that's my participation in comedy. So it's like really, I like want everything all the time. I'm like, oh, this all seems like so much fun. Why can't I do everything? And it's like, well, there's limited hours in the day. And I just have to like, stop kicking my own butt so hard about like, why aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. That's good. That's good that you realize that, and you're not kicking your own butt so hard, because you shouldn't be doing that at all. Yeah, I was really struck by how much of your 1 hour set was based on your own personal life. How do you decide how much of your personal life you want to share with your audience?
Oh, that's a great question. I feel pretty comfortable sharing a lot of things about my life. I've been doing this since I was 19. So like, it is part of my adult life, for better and/or worse. But I really try to make sure that the people in my life that I talk about feel at least that I'm being fair.
So I was running down this whole story for a friend, and I told her the last thing that I learned from the doctors, which is that they don't know what causes this, but sometimes it's concurrent with a serious migraine, so they think it might be related. And my friend was like, that's interesting, Josh, because I was just reading a long magazine article about global transient amnesia, and what I read is that it can also be brought on concurrently with a powerful orgasm. My mom doesn't love when I tell that story, despite the incredibly flattering light it paints her in. My dad has no recollection I've ever said this to anyone, so it's fine. We're fine.
But the one thing that I've done on TV that is that there's a bone of contention is my dad insists that he's never worn suspenders with sweatpants, which I've said in a joke that he has. And he's not mad about it, but it's a lingering, like, he'll still bring it up. I'd be like, you know, I've never actually worn the suspenders or the sweatpants.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a chance to have lunch with your 97-year-old great aunt a while back. You mentioned that she had a lot of swagger and hubris. Do you think you've inherited any of her swagger and hubris?
I hope so. I think my aunt sis passed away, and she had just such an amazing life and was like writing books and really engaged, seeing family and until the very last days of her life.
The hubris comes out in different ways. We were out at lunch. We finished the meal. The waiter comes over. He says, can I interest you in dessert? I have one dessert special to offer. It's a slice of pumpkin pie. And my great aunt looks him right in the eyes, grown man, and says, we'll have some grapes for the table. And the waiter says, grapes? And she goes, for the table. And the waiter walks out of the room, presumably to quit, is what I thought was happening. She's like, oh boy, better go back to law school, like my dad keeps saying. Comes back 2 minutes later with 3 giant bowls of grapes for the table.
I just am so glad to share her kind of spirit through this joke with the people that watched the special, because she was really a wonderful, special person.
Mm, yeah, that's great. Near the end of your special, you share this very beautiful, very poignant, and funny story about how you knew you wanted to be with your wife, Maris, forever. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I've told this story a few times before, but this is one of the bits that I'm like, man, I really love this, and I'm so glad I can do it in this visual way that hopefully will reach more people, because it's one of my favorite stories to tell. And it's just about, it was the day of my grandmother's funeral, and on the way into the city, we heard the song Caress Me Down by Sublime, which I think is kind of a goofy song. It is a song that is like too sexually explicit. Like, it's phenomenal that it gets played on the radio. I think part of it is that some of the very sexual stuff is in Spanish, and the people in Boston are like, none of us know what that means, guy.
So she's singing. I'm laughing so hard. She keeps going, right? She's just singing the whole song. She's like, kiss me neck and tickle me fancy. Tickle me fancy. What are you, a horny pirate? You gotta walk the plank on out of this car. I have to reevaluate things. So we get into the city. We have a couple drinks with some old friends. It's just so lovely to have this experience of like lightening the day a little bit with some good friends, some old friends, people I hadn't seen in years, but it felt like we'd been together the day before. It was wonderful. So we get in the car to go home after a suitable waiting period. We weren't trying to become Massachusetts sober that evening. And we turn on the radio, and the first song on the radio that we hear is Caress Me Down by Sublime again. At that point, I was like, have I angered a wizard?
we get back to my parents' house and we're in bed about to fall asleep. And it's been a really long day, you know, got up for the funeral and spent all afternoon with family. And it was really lovely, but just being kind of on in that way, like, okay, I'm present with people all day long. Well, it was like, you know, it's emotionally really taxing, even though it was very comforting to be around so many people I love. And she, my girlfriend at the time, now wife, said to me very softly, she said, "Josh, kiss my neck." And I just said, "Anything you want, kiss your neck, rub your feet. You've been there for me today, and anything I can do for you to reciprocate, of course I will," without thinking about it. So I lean in to kiss her neck, and she kind of turns her head to look at me and goes, "And tickle me fancy." And it's like truly one of the hardest laughs of my entire life. It was like such a beautiful moment. And just that there was like this comfort of like her doing this bit on such an emotionally loaded day and just knowing like that it would be delightful to me. And that she was just so, we were so in tune with that. And she was just such a wonderful, loving, supportive partner all day. And I was just like, oh, this is one of the most special people that I've ever met, and I love her so much, and I am just like so grateful for this relationship.
Yeah, it's proof that you two crazy kids were made for each other.
It really felt that way.
Yeah. Sorry, and it comes across that way. Thank you for sharing that story. Josh Gondelman, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on People Pleaser. We're looking forward to People Pleaser Part 2. You'll come up with a better title, of course.
I mean, I'm really excited to do like that next. Like, I can't wait to put out another hour too. Like, I really enjoyed the process of like putting together the material, shooting it, editing it, coming, like working with an artist on the artwork. It's been like, it was really exciting. And I'm like, ooh, I hope I get to do another one in the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully within the next year. I know, no extra pressure on you. but we look forward to seeing it. Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you.
Josh Gondelman is a comedian and the head writer and an executive producer of Desus and Merrill on Showtime. His comedy special, People Pleaser, is now streaming. If it pleases you to find out more about Josh, you can do so at wpr.org/beta.
There's some fun Easter eggs throughout where you may see a character just on the edges kind of reappear. And I just find that to be a fun experience in reading and something that I had fun incorporating.
Coming up, Chelsea Beaker joins us to talk about her powerful short story collection, Heartbroken. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.